In the box. 1. On March 27th, Andy McGee decided abruptly that they could stay in Tashmore no longer. It had been more than 2 weeks since he had mailed his letters, and if anything was going to come of them, it already would have. The very fact of the continuing silence around Granther's camp made him uneasy. He supposed he could simply have been dismissed out of hand as a crackpot in every case, but he didn't believe it. What he believed, what his deepest intuition whispered, was that his letters had been somehow diverted. And that would mean they knew where he and Charlie were. "We're going," he told Charlie. "Let's get our stuff together." She only looked at him with her careful eyes, a little scared, and said nothing. She didn't ask him where they were going or what they were going to do, and that made him nervous, too. In one of the closets, he found two old suitcases plastered with ancient vacation decals, Grand Rapids, Niagara Falls, Miami Beach, and the two of them began to sort what they would take and what they would leave. Blinding bright sunlight streamed in through the windows on the east side of the cottage. Water dripped and gurgled in the downspouts. The night before, he had got little sleep. The ice had gone out, and he had lain awake listening to it. The high, ethereal, and somehow uncanny sound of the old yellow ice splitting and moving slowly down toward the neck of the pond, where the great Hancock River spilled eastward across New Hampshire and all of Maine, growing progressively more smelly and polluted until it vomited, noisome and dead, into the Atlantic. The sound was like a prolonged crystal note, or perhaps that of a bow drawn endlessly across a high violin string, a constant fluted zing that settled over the nerve endings and seemed to make them vibrate in sympathy. He had never been here at Ice Out before and was not sure he would ever want to be again. There was something terrible and otherworldly about that sound as it vibrated between the silent evergreen walls of this low and eroded bowl of hills. He felt that they were very near again, like the barely seen monster in a recurring nightmare. The day after Charlie's birthday, he had been on one of his tramps. The cross-country skis buckled uncomfortably onto his feet, and he had come across a line of snowshoe tracks leading up to a tall spruce tree. There were indents in the crust like periods where the snowshoes had been taken off and jammed into the snow on their tails. There was a flurried confusion where the wearer had later refastened his snowshoes. Slush boats, Granther had always called them, holding them in contempt for some obscure reason of his own. At the base of the tree, Andy had found 6 Vantage cigarette butts and a crumpled yellow package that had once contained Kodak Tri-X film. More uneasy than ever, he had taken off the skis and climbed up into the tree. Halfway up, he had found himself on a direct line of sight with Granther's cottage a mile away. It was small and apparently empty, but with a telephoto lens. He hadn't mentioned his find to Charlie. The suitcases were packed. Her continued silence forced him into nervous speech, as if by not talking she was accusing him. "We're going to hitch a ride into Berlin," he said, "and then we'll get a Greyhound back to New York City. We're going to the offices of the New York Times."
"But, Daddy, you sent them a letter."
"Honey, they might not have gotten it." She looked at him in silence for a moment and then said, "Do you think they took it?" "Of course he shook his head and started again. "Charlie, I just don't know." Charlie didn't reply. She knelt, closed one of the suitcases, and began fumbling ineffectually with the clasps. "Let me help you, hon."
"I can do it,"
she screamed at him, and then began to cry. "Charlie, don't," he said. "Please, hon, it's almost over."
"No, it's not," she said, crying harder. "It's never going to be over."
2. There were an even dozen agents around Granther McGee's cabin. They had taken up their positions the night before. They all wore mottled white and green clothing. None of them had been at the Manders farm, and none of them was armed except for John Rainbird, who had the rifle, and Don Jules, who carried a .22 pistol. "I am taking no chances of having someone panic because of what happened back in New York," Rainbird had told Cap. "That Jameson still looks as if his balls are hanging around his knees." Similarly, he would not hear of the agents going armed. Things had a way of happening, and he didn't want to come out of the operation with 2 corpses. He had handpicked all of the agents, and the one he had chosen to take Andy McGee was Don Jules. Jules was small, 30-ish, silent, morose. He was good at his job. Rainbird knew because Jules was the only man he had chosen to work with more than once. He was quick and practical. He did not get in the way at critical moments. McGee will be out at some point during the day, Rainbird had told them at the briefing. The girl usually comes out, but McGee always does. If the man comes out alone, I'll take him, and Jules will get him out of sight quickly and quietly. If the girl should come out alone, same thing. If they come out together, I'll take the girl, and Jules will take McGee. The rest of you are just spear carriers. Do you understand that? Rainbird's eye glared over them. You're there in case something goes drastically wrong, and that is all. Of course, if something does go drastically wrong, most of you will be running for the lake with your pants on fire. You're along in case that one chance in 100 turns up where you can do something. Of course, it's understood that you're also along as observers and witnesses in case I fuck up. This had earned a thin and nervous chuckle. Rainbird raised one finger. If any one of you miscues and puts their wind up somehow, I'll personally see that you end up in the lousiest jungle valley of South America I can find, with a cord asshole. Believe that, gentlemen. You are spear carriers in my show. Remember it. Later, at their staging area, an abandoned motel in St. Johnsbury, Rainbird had taken John Jules aside. You have read the file on this man? Rainbird said. Jules was smoking a Camel. Yeah. You understand the concept of mental domination? Yeah. You understand what happened to the two men in Ohio? The men that tried to take his daughter away? I worked with George Waring, Jules said evenly. That guy could burn water making tea. In this man's outfit, that is not so unusual. I only need us to be clear. You'll need to be very quick. Yeah, okay. He's had a whole winter to rest, this guy. If he gets time to give you a shot, you're a good candidate to spend the next 3 years of your life in a padded room thinking you're a bird or a turnip or something. All right. All right, what? I'll be quick. Give it a rest, John. There's a good chance they will come out together, Rainbird said, ignoring him. You'll be around the corner of the porch, out of sight of the door where they'll come out. You wait for me to take the girl. Her father will go to her. You'll be behind him. Get him in the neck. Sure. Don't screw this up, Don. Jules smiled briefly and smoked. No, he said. 3. The suitcases were packed. Charlie had put on her coat and her snow pants. Andy shrugged into his own jacket, zipped it, and picked up the suitcases. He didn't feel good, not at all good. He had the jumps, one of his hunches. You feel it too, don't you? Charlie asked. Her small face was pale and expressionless. Andy nodded reluctantly. What do we do? We hope the feeling's a little early, he said, although in his heart he didn't think it was so. What else can we do? What else can we do? She echoed. She came to him then and lifted her arms to be picked up, something he couldn't remember her doing for a long time, maybe 2 years. It was amazing how time got by, how quickly a child could change in front of your eyes with an unobtrusiveness that was nearly terrible. He put the suitcases down and picked her up and hugged her. She kissed his cheek and then hugged him again, very tightly. Are you ready? He asked, setting her down. I guess so, Charlie said. She was close to tears again. Daddy, I won't make fires, not even if they come before we can get away. Yes, he said. That's all right, Charlie. I understand that. I love you, Dad. He nodded. I love you too, kiddo. Andy went to the door and opened it. For a moment, the sunlight was so bright that he could see nothing at all. Then his pupils contracted and the day cleared before him, bright with melting snow. To his right was Tashmore Pond, dazzling, jaggedly irregular patches of blue water showing between the floating chunks of ice. Straight ahead were pine woods. Through them he could barely see the green shingled roof of the next camp, free of snow at last. The woods were still, and Andy's feeling of disquiet intensified. Where was the birdsong that had greeted their mornings ever since the winter temperatures had begun to moderate?
There was none today, only the drip of snow melting from the branches. He found himself wishing desperately that Grantham had put in a phone out here. He had to restrain an urge to shout, "Who's there?" at the top of his lungs, but that would only frighten Charlie more. "Looks fine," he said. "I think we're still ahead of them, if they're coming at all." "That's good," she said colorlessly. "Let's hit the road, kid," Andy said, and thought for the 100th time, what else is there to do? And thought again how much he hated them. Charlie came across the room to him, past the drainer full of dishes they had washed that morning after breakfast. The entire cottage was the way they had found it, spick and span. Grantham would have been pleased. Andy slipped an arm around Charlie's shoulders and gave her one more brief hug. Then he picked up the suitcases, and they stepped out into the early spring sunshine together. 4. John Rainbird was halfway up a tall spruce 150 yards away. He was wearing lineman's spikes on his feet, and a lineman's belt held him firmly against the trunk of the tree. When the cabin door opened, he threw the rifle to his shoulder and seated it firmly. Total calm fell over him in a reassuring cloak. Everything became startlingly clear in front of his one good eye. When he lost his other eye, he had suffered a blurring of his depth perception, but at moments of extreme concentration, like this one, his old clear seeing came back to him. It was as if the ruined eye could regenerate itself for brief periods. It was not a long shot, and he would not have wasted a moment's worry if it had been a bullet he was planning to put through the girl's neck, but he was dealing with something far more clumsy, something that jumped the risk element by a factor of 10. Fixed inside the barrel of this specially modified rifle was a dart tipped with an ampule of orosin, and at this distance there was always a chance it might tumble or veer. Luckily, the day was almost without wind. "If it is the will of the Great Spirit and of my ancestors," Rainbird prayed silently, "guide my hands and my eye that the shot may be true." The girl came out with her father by her side. Jules was in it then. Through the telescopic sight, the girl looked as big as a barn door. The parka was a bright blue blaze against the weathered boards of the cabin. Rainbird had a moment to note the suitcases in McGee's hands to realize they were just in time, after all. The girl's hood was down, the tab of her zipper pulled up only to her breastbone, so that the coat spread open slightly at the throat. The day was warm, and that was in his favor, too. He tightened down on the trigger and sighted the crosshairs on the base of her throat. "If it is the will..." He squeezed the trigger. There was no explosion, only a hollow pfft and a small curl of smoke from the rifle's breech. 5. They were on the edge of the steps when Charlie suddenly stopped and made a strangled swallowing noise. Andy dropped the suitcases immediately. He had heard nothing, but something was terribly wrong. Something about Charlie had changed. "Charlie? Charlie!" He stared at her. She stood as still as a statue, incredibly beautiful against the bright snowfield, incredibly small. And suddenly he realized what the change was. It was so fundamental, so awful, that he had not been able to grasp it at first. What appeared to be a long needle was sticking out of Charlie's throat just below the Adam's apple. Her mittened hand groped for it, found it, twisted it to a new and grotesque upward jutting angle. A thin trickle of blood began to flow from the wound and down the side of her throat. A flower of blood, small and delicate, stained the collar of her shirt and just touched the edging of fake fur that bordered the zipper of her parka. "Charlie!" he screamed. He leaped forward and grabbed her arm just as her eyes rolled up and she pitched outward. He led her down to the porch, crying her name over and over. The dart in her throat twinkled brightly in the sun. Her body had the loose, boneless feel of a dead thing. He held her, cradled her, and looked out at the sunshiny woods that seemed so empty and where no birds sang. "Who did it?" he screamed. "Who did it? Come out where I can see you." Don Jules stepped around the corner of the porch. He was wearing Adidas tennis sneakers. He held the .22 in one hand. "Who shot my daughter?" Andy screamed. Something in his throat vibrated painfully with the force of his scream. He held her to him, so terribly loose and boneless inside her warm blue parka. His fingers went to the dart and pulled it out, starting a fresh trickle of blood.
Get her inside, he thought. Got to get her inside. Jules approached him and shot him in the back of the neck, much as the actor Booth had once shot a president. For a moment, Andy jerked upward on his knees, holding Charlie even more tightly against him. Then he collapsed forward over her. Jules looked at him closely, then waved the men out of the woods. Nothing to it, he said to himself as Rainbird came toward the cabin, wading through the sticky, melting snow of late March. Nothing to it. What was all the fuss about?